HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Humans vs. Nature, A Global Environmental History, by Daniel R. Hedrick, read by David Stifel. Publisher's Note: all figures and tables referenced in this audiobook can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book. Introduction. Global Environmental History. In 1928, John Widsoe, director of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Reclamation, wrote, "The destiny of man is to possess the whole earth, and the destiny of the earth is to be subject to man. There can be no full conquest of the earth, and no real satisfaction to humanity, if large portions of the earth remain beyond his highest control." Since Widsoe wrote these words, the conquest of the earth has proceeded apace. World population has more than tripled. Consumer goods are more plentiful, living standards have risen, and new technologies have transformed the lives of millions. Roads, railroads, airports, cities, and mines cover far more of the surface of the planet. Land once forested has been turned into pastures and farmland. Large parts of the oceans have been depleted of fish and polluted with trash and oil. The atmosphere contains more methane and carbon dioxide, and more species of wild animals and plants have become extinct or reduced to tiny numbers. The changes in the world since 1928 have largely been man-made, at the expense of wild plants and animals and natural landscapes. Until recently, most people in the West applauded this achievement. After all, didn't it have divine sanction? As the Bible said, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." Yet in recent decades, an increasing number of voices have decried the possession of the earth as an environmental crisis, marked by pollution, depletion of resources, deforestation, and the extinction of species. This raises the question, when did humans begin to damage the earth? In other words, when did the crisis begin? Historians and scientists have answered this question in a variety of ways. In 2000, Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric chemist Paul Crutzen and ecologist Eugene Sturmer coined the term Anthropocene to refer to the era when humans began to have a major impact on the environment. He argued that this era began with the Industrial Revolution of the late 18th century, when analyses of air trapped in polar ice showed the beginning of growing global concentrations of carbon dioxide and methane. He even gave a specific date, 1784, to coincide with James Watt's design of the steam engine. Historian Stephen Mosley has argued that the root causes of the current crisis can be found back in the 16th century, when the world of nature was reconceptualized as machine-like to meet the needs of an emergent capitalism. This new scientific worldview saw nature as dead matter for human utilization. Going further back in time, medievalist Lynn White Jr., in a famous article entitled "The Historical Roots of Our Ecologic Crisis," argued that indifference to nature originated in early medieval Europe, when the distribution of land was no longer based on the needs of a family, but rather on the capacity of a power machine, the 8-oxen plow, to till the earth. Man's relation to the soil was profoundly changed. Formerly, man had been part of nature. Now he was the exploiter of nature. Behind the machine, White continued, was a new religious view of the world. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. Long before the Middle Ages, environmental scientist Earl Ellis and his colleagues argued relatively small human populations likely caused widespread and profound ecological changes more than 3,000 years ago. Taking an even wider chronological view, environmental historian Sing Chu claimed that the history of civilizations, kingdoms, empires, and states is also the history of ecological degradation and crisis. Such a historical trajectory of human macroparasitic activity has occurred at the system-wide structural level for at least the last 5,000 years. Finally, climatologist William Ruddiman traced the beginning of the human impact on the planet to the first farmers and herders of the Neolithic Age, some 10,000 years ago. What this debate shows is the very human yet futile custom of attaching dates to a long-term process. The human impact on the environment began in a very small way very long ago, but grew gradually in fits and starts until the 18th century, then began to rise ever more sharply at an accelerating pace until the present. What has changed over time was not the desire of humans to exploit their environments, but the technological and organizational means they developed and employed against the rest of nature, and their consequences. Humans and Nature. All living beings survive by extracting resources from their environments. In the process, they compete with other living beings. Some flourish, some barely survive, and some become extinct. Yet nature has ways of preventing any one species from overwhelming and destroying the others. One way is by limiting the supply of resources available in a given environment. For each species, the environment's carrying capacity fluctuates widely due to predation, diseases, climate change, and other factors. Lynxes survive by eating rabbits, so once they have decimated the rabbits in their area, many lynxes will starve, allowing the rabbit population to recover, followed by a recovery of the lynx population, and so on. Another way is by limiting the amount of resources any given creature can absorb at one time. A lion, having lunched on a gazelle, will take a nap in the shade of a tree, digesting his meal before undertaking another hunt. Humans, however, continue to take resources from their environment long after their needs are met. In 19th century America, hunters armed with rifles killed as many bison as they could, taking only their tongues, sometimes shooting them for the sheer pleasure of killing. Long before Europeans came with their rifles, American Indians stampeded herds of bison over cliffs in order to take the meat from a few of them. Everywhere they went, Stone Age hunters exterminated many of the largest and fiercest animals that roamed the earth. Since the appearance of Homo sapiens, the motivation to take as many resources from the environment as technology allows has been a human characteristic. Much of history consists of humans' gradual acquisition of the means to realize their desires at the expense of the rest of nature. Humans have time and again found ways to overcome the limitations of their physical abilities through ingenious technological and organizational innovations, allowing them to thrive in almost every environment. Already in prehistoric times, they set fire to forests, drained wetlands, plowed the soil, domesticated plants and animals, and built elaborate irrigation systems. Most of these activities allowed more people to survive and reproduce, and later to create states and high cultures. Despite many setbacks, human victories over nature have outnumbered their defeats. In modern times, as technological changes have accelerated, humans have acquired ever greater powers to transform the natural environment for their own benefit. Today, humans have the means to clear-cut entire forests, appropriate all accessible fresh water, change the climate, and possess the whole earth. Yet, it would be wrong to think of the human impact on the environment in solely negative terms. Domesticated animals, as well as hangers-on such as roaches and sparrows, are far more numerous than they would be without us. The same is true of domesticated plants and weeds. At the same time, the natural world still has agency and periodically disrupts the human urge to subdue, dominate, and possess. Droughts, floods, hurricanes, and other weather anomalies are reminders of this power. Volcanoes, earthquakes, and tsunamis wreak havoc. And periodically, epidemics put entire populations at risk. Some natural events that harm humans are themselves the unintended consequences of human actions. Burning fossil fuels emits greenhouse gases that cause global warming. And global warming, in turn, causes weather anomalies that affect human societies. New means of transportation allow diseases like cholera, SARS, and Zika to spread quickly. Antibiotics fed to farm animals encourage the emergence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that endanger human health. Finally, humans are highly dependent on the natural world, not just those parts of nature we have domesticated, but also those we have not. The forests that absorb carbon and emit oxygen, the wildernesses that offer respite from the stresses of civilization, and the myriad plants, animals, and microorganisms that promise scientific breakthroughs to benefit humanity. In other words, as ecologists stress, everything in nature, including humans, is interconnected and interacts in complex feedback loops. This book examines these complex interactions between humans and the rest of nature. Two aspects particularly stand out. One is the human impacts on the rest of nature and how they have changed over time. The other is how nature, in turn, has affected humans and human civilizations, especially the natural disasters that have disrupted and sometimes reversed the advancing power of humans over the natural world. Examples of both kinds of interactions abound in the chapters that follow. Chapters 1 through 3 are largely chronological, following the evolution of human societies from hunters and gatherers to farmers and herders and to the first civilizations. Not all regions of the world went through all of these phases, and those that did followed the sequence at different times. The first chapter relates the difficult and contentious relations between early humans and the environments in which they lived. Early humans were extremely vulnerable to the forces of nature, and at one point almost went extinct. Yet their descendants migrated to every continent except Antarctica, and learned to survive in environments for which their bodies were totally unsuited. Once arrived in a new environment, using only fire and simple handheld weapons, they exterminated numerous species of large animals, as no creature had done before. Chapter 2 describes the domestication of plants and animals that allowed the rise of two kinds of communities, settled agricultural villages and nomadic herding bands. In the process, humans changed landscapes by transforming forests and natural grasslands into farms and pastures. Though the human population increased, their health and stature declined, and new diseases appeared. Chapter 3 recounts the appearance of complex hierarchical societies around the world. Remarkably, many early civilizations were organized around the control of water, irrigation, drainage, and the struggle against floods. Some societies were almost destroyed by droughts, while others proved more resilient. Starting in Chapter 4, the narrative takes a geographical turn as the history of the two hemispheres diverges. Chapter 4 describes how humans increasingly farmed on rain-watered lands and vastly expanded the area in Eurasia and Africa they occupied from the mid-second millennium BCE to the 7th century CE. but the increased contacts between large-scale societies made them vulnerable to pandemics, such as the plague. The following chapter recounts the consequences of the medieval climate anomaly, a particularly warm period from the 8th to the 14th centuries, for the development of large-scale societies throughout Eurasia and sub-Saharan Africa. In many parts of the Eastern Hemisphere, however, human encroachments on nature were reversed by the beginnings of the Little Ice Age and the calamity of the Black Death. Chapter 6 describes the enormous biological changes that accompanied the opening of contacts between the Eastern and Western hemispheres from the 16th to the 18th centuries. Diseases imported from Europe and Africa reduced the indigenous population of the Americas by 9/10 or more, allowing the recovery of forests and wildlife. At the same time, the Americas were invaded by Old World plants and animals, some of which went feral and dramatically changed the environments of the New World. Chapter 7 looks at this period in the Eastern Hemisphere. Climatically, this was the Little Ice Age that precipitated major economic and political crises. The peoples of the Eastern Hemisphere survived the crisis, and in a few places even flourished, thanks to the bounty provided by New World crops. Chapters 8 and 9 focus on industrialization and the sudden increase in the power of humans over nature that it provided. Its effects diverged sharply, with the Western nations as centers of power and non-Western regions as objects of transformations imposed from outside. Chapter 8 introduces the Industrial Revolution and its impact on the environments of two major industrializing countries. In both Great Britain and the United States, cities and industries expanded dramatically, polluting local air and water. The impact of American industrialization was especially severe and widespread, leading to the plunder of natural resources, the destruction of arable soils and forests, and the decimation or the extinction of several species of wildlife. At the same time, industrialization encouraged the population to grow fast and reduced people's vulnerability to natural shocks. Chapter 9 looks at the non-industrializing part of the world, especially monsoon Asia in the same period. India, China, and Southeast Asia, but also Egypt and Brazil, were profoundly affected by Western industrialization, especially by the demand for tropical crops that led to a vast expansion of arable land at the expense of forests and their fauna and flora. Although the population of the affected regions increased, standards of living did not, and people remained as vulnerable as ever to floods, droughts, and epidemics. Two thematic chapters cover the 20th century. Chapter 10 deals with the environmental impact of both world wars and conflicts such as the Vietnam War. It also discusses major development schemes, as in the Soviet Union, the United States, China under Mao, and Brazil, and the effect of these schemes and projects on forests, wildlife, and other environments. Chapter 11 looks at peacetime economies and the rise of mass consumerism and its environmental costs, especially the impact of automobiles, petroleum, and industrial agriculture. The areas covered include the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and China after Mao. The next three chapters take up current environmental issues in their historical contexts. Chapter 12 describes the recent climate change and its causes, as well as scientific predictions and possible future scenarios. It also discusses the politics of global warming, both nationally and internationally, and the public reaction to the issue and to the debates. Chapter 13 goes underwater to reveal the impact of hunting on whale populations and the collapse of cod stocks through overfishing. It discusses the sustainability of salmon populations through farming and the control of wild salmon fishing. It also describes the impact of humans on the oceans in the form of dead zones, coral bleaching, and the accumulation of garbage. Chapter 14 addresses the extinction of terrestrial species as a natural phenomenon, and with the five extraordinary mass extinctions in the history of the Earth, such as the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. We are currently witnessing a sixth mass extinction, this one caused by human beings through habitat destruction, hunting, and global warming, especially in the tropical rainforests and in the Arctic. The chapter also deals with the survival and multiplication of plants and animals selected and encouraged by humans, but also weeds, pests, and pathogens that benefit from unintentional human actions. The last two chapters address responses to the current environmental crisis. Chapter 15 considers human attitudes toward nature. Traditional societies devised rules and taboos to protect aspects of the natural world that they valued, such as sacred woods or hunting preserves. While deeply held, these beliefs and behaviors slowed down but never reversed people's desire to use nature for their own benefit. Since the 19th century, environmentalists have been decrying the damage that untrammeled development has inflicted on the natural environment. In recent decades, their voices have entered the political discourse. As a result, modern states have tried to mitigate the impact on the natural world through restrictions on pollution, laws to protect endangered species, national parks and wilderness areas, international agreements on fishing and whaling, and nuclear arms limitation treaties. In the 21st century, humanity faces difficult decisions, as discussed in the epilogue. The need to protect what is left of the natural environment is clear. At the same time, the pressure to continue along the path of expansion and development is more powerful than ever. We humans have now outsmarted all other living beings and taken over much of the planet. Yet we march backward into the future, blind to what is to come. What can the story of the past teach us about ourselves and how we should interact with the planet we live on? Will technological breakthroughs allow us to continue enjoying the benefits of past innovations while mitigating the harm they have inflicted on the environment? As we take ever greater control over the Earth, as though it were the planet machine, will we operate it with wisdom, restraint, and balance? Qualities humans have so seldom displayed in the past. Chapter 1. The Foragers. It is tempting, looking back at the history of humanity, to believe that it was our destiny, by divine right or because of our superior intelligence, to become the dominant species on Earth. Yet 200,000 years ago, when the first Homo sapiens appeared, there were other members of the genus Homo, Homo erectus, Denisovans, Neanderthals, to name a few. One by one, they went extinct, and only Homo sapiens survived. It is by chance that we survived while other species died out. Yet humans differed from other species of the genus Homo from very early times. Even as they lived at the mercy of natural forces, they also began transforming their environments in ways no other species did. At a site in the Czech Republic, archaeologists found the bones of 1,000 mammoths killed by humans. At sites in Colorado and Wyoming, they found the remains of herds of bison stampeded over cliffs. And in New Zealand, hundreds of thousands of skeletons of moas, gigantic flightless birds, were found near Maori hunting sites. In many parts of the world, humans killed large numbers of great animals, some of whom went extinct soon after humans arrived on the scene. Humans also transformed plant life, either directly by setting fire to forests to encourage open grasslands, or indirectly by killing the animals that kept certain plants in check. In short, Homo sapiens caused major changes in the environment almost as soon as they appeared on Earth. Homo erectus. The designation Homo is an honorific bestowed upon a genus of bipedal animals by those of us who call ourselves Homo sapiens, or knowing man. Between Australopithecines and ourselves were many hominid species. Most went extinct, but one lineage survived to become the ancestors of Homo sapiens. The most recent of our now extinct ancestors were creatures we call Homo erectus, standing man, a species that appeared in Africa between 1.9 and 1.6 million years ago. Unlike earlier hominins who spent part of their time in trees, Homo erectus were full-time ground dwellers. Their teeth and jaw muscles were smaller than those of their predecessors, too small to chew raw meat efficiently. They had a smaller gut than earlier hominins, indicating that they did not need to spend as much energy and time digesting as other carnivores. They may also have lost the fur that covered other primates, and instead developed sweat glands that allowed them to spend long stretches under the hot sun. Their brain volume measured up to 950 cubic centimeters, two-thirds the size of ours. Such a brain required a lot of energy, which they obtained from a diet that included meat. With a larger brain came better tools. Because the only tools that have survived were those made of stone, archaeologists call this period of prehistory the Paleolithic, or Old Stone Age. Earlier hominins, as far back as the Australopithecines 3 to 4 million years before, had made rough choppers by breaking a piece off a cobble, leaving a sharp edge. Homo erectus were able to obtain 60 centimeters of a cutting edge from a kilogram of flint, four times more than previous hominins. They created a toolkit consisting of stones carved to form hammers, cleavers, or choppers, along with the associated flakes. Such tools remained in use, with some refinements, for a million years. In addition, Homo erectus almost certainly used wooden sticks, or in East Asia, bamboo, though evidence thereof has long since perished. Homo erectus were the first hominins to migrate out of Africa, probably following herds of herbivores seeking better grazing lands during a dry period some 1.8 million years ago. In many places, they joined the ranks of the dominant predators. In Africa, they displaced saber-toothed cats and the remaining Australopithecines. Archaeologists have found remains of Homo erectus and the animals they killed in China, the Caucasus, Hungary, Java, Spain, and France, as well as Africa. At two sites in Spain, Torralba and Embrona, they found the bones of 30 elephants, as well as deer, aurochs, wild cattle, and rhinoceroses. That does not mean that erectus attacked such large and dangerous prey in the open. They killed and butchered animals mired in a swamp. Fire and food. What most sharply distinguished Homo erectus from all other creatures was their systematic use of fire. According to some anthropologists, direct physical remains of their fires, such as charcoal, burned bones, and hearths made of stones, occur at Bouche de l'Escale in France, dated between 350,000 and 250,000 years ago, followed by Vertes-sous-Louche in Hungary and Terra Amata in France around 250,000 years ago, and by 150,000-year-old ash deposits in Hayonim Cave in Israel. Traces of fire became more numerous after that, both in Western Europe and in China. After 110,000 years ago, there are abundant remains. Earlier hominins may have made use of natural fires started by lightning. Archaeologists have found burned seeds, wood, and flint at Gersher Beno Yaakov dating back at least 790,000 years. In addition, According to anthropologist Richard Wrangham, there are
sample complete. Ready to continue?